Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 20th of May 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 38 in our series here where we take a patriotic look at our history, and at the moment in this section we are looking at British history and particularly the Druids once again. And of course I do have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, how are you doing? How's life treating you?
I'm well, thanks. It was my birthday yesterday. Yesterday. Went home for the weekend. Spent time with family. Went out on Saturday, drove out to a place called Hardwick Hall in Chesterfield. It's a really, really nice place, that.
Stately home, is it?
It's like a nature reserve, but a really kind of large, expansive, piece of land, and there's a large kind of castle and hall around, but just the walks, and there's this sort of natural ponds, and it's just a really nice place to be, go for a walk and, you know, enjoy the beautiful nature of Britain. It's kind of truly unique, really, compared to a lot of other places. Obviously the wife's from Romania and the landscapes are nice there, but just something about England, the English hills.
I was in England as well over the weekend. I was in Oswestry with PA Wales, and we had a look at an earthwork there, which was like a pre-Roman enclosure. And, it's huge, absolutely massive. Mm. Three great embankments, and you can imagine this is where the people that we're talking about now, where they would have lived, where the Druids would have been, where the Britons would have been, where they would have fought the Romans from. Before they had the big stone structures, we were talking about the timber structures that they had. I mean, it's a huge, huge earthwork there. There's another one down in Dorset, Maiden Castle. And you think the landscape, the countryside looks as if it's just been there forever, but it's all been shaped by human hand for thousands of years. All the enclosures, the stone walling, the embankments, everything. Way back at the start, it was all forest land, wasn't it? And all that had to be levelled.
Exactly.
Since then, it's all been shaped. Yeah, it's beautiful to get out. Beautiful to get out and about. As I say, this is our third look at Druidry and its effect on Britain and British religion. And this week, we're going to be looking at the connections between Druidry and Christianity. And I'm hoping that at the end of it, we will finally have time to look at how traces of Druidry can still be seen in some of the traditions that we have today. And the first book that I'm going to be quoting from, because unfortunately I couldn't get notes copied up for this episode, because these two books are not available on PDF. I'm having to quote from the copies that I have here in my library. And the first one we're going to use is Stonehenge and Druidism by E. Raymond Capt. And E. Raymond Capt is a favourite author of mine. He's got lots of letters after his name, MAAIAFSASCOT. And he basically looks at the Old Testament and the New Testament and how that fits in with European history. And he's got a whole section on Druidism here that I thought would be good to get into. And if people want to find his work, they can find him at Artisan Publishers in America and Covenant Publishing in Britain. And he begins, "A writer of antiquity once wrote, 'The history of a nation is the history of its religion, its attempts to seek after and serve its God.' It is noteworthy that in ancient Babylon, Persia, and Asia, few ruins of palaces or dwellings are found. Mostly, we find magnificent remains of temples. They witness to the importance the people of these countries attached to their religious worship. This has always been true of Great Britain, where the standing stone monuments from Orkney in the north to Cornwall in the south witness to the vigour and vitality of its national religion, Druidism, one of the oldest religions in the world." So I'll just stop there. I mean, that is a point, quite an important point there, is that is mainly what we find is temples in the Near East. So when we find stone circles and dolmens and the like in Britain and in Europe, it's obvious they must have had something to do with the religion, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's definitely correlations there. And I mean, we referenced the dolmens being unhewed rock, didn't we? Previous episodes, and that kind of links to the commandments towards the Israelites of what they were supposed to do when in their, you know, in their migrations, to almost leave their mark in hewed rocks.
Yeah, waymarks, and put them up, and put limestone on them, and not to use iron tools upon them. I also think it's interesting here, it says the history of a nation is the history of its religion, because everything was to do with religion back then. Science was to do with religion. It was all about serving the gods, or serving God in the correct way. I think the Hindus call it Dharma. It's just living in keeping with the correct way that you're supposed to be living. Unlike today, where it's all become completely divorced, the religion was everything. You know, the oath that you took to God to serve the people and to serve the state. Without that fear of God, people are going to break their oaths. I mean, that's what the whole system is based upon, is swearing oaths. And if you don't believe in God, then, you know, there's no incentive to actually keep your oath. There's no fear. The fear of God is what kept things going, I think.
Mm.
Now we have, what do we have today? Fear of closed circuit TV cameras. There was no need for closed circuit TV cameras when you thought God was watching your every move.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely an incentive, you know.
Well, under Druidism, Britain developed a high standard of religion, justice, and a code of moral teaching that influenced her national character. On the principle, the truth against the world, dedicated priests built up a highly organized religious institution that wielded authority over the people of other nations. This priesthood established a system of national colleges under the supreme authority of arch-druids, who became philosophers of renown to the outside world. And we talked about that in the previous couple of episodes, the quotes from the Greek authors that were talking about the druids. And we also talked about this motto that they had, the truth against the world, which is like Logos against the world, Christ against the world. And it does seem as if it could have come out of the New Testament, that motto, I think. Although modern historians accept that Druidism was the religion of ancient Britain, they consider it unlikely that there was any Druids in Britain until many centuries after Stonehenge was built. The accepted theory is that the Druids were a Celtic priesthood which flourished in Britain beginning a few centuries before the Roman conquest. And of course, what we learned last week is that there are records which talk about the beginning of Druidry and when that took place within the sign of Taurus. And this is why the white bull was the symbol of the Druids. And the bit about Stonehenge, I mean, they say that that was built, I think, 2500 BC or 3500 BC. And I don't see how they can actually tell when these stones were erected, because the stone is obviously going to be much older than when it was first stood up on end. And how are you going to tell when it's first stood up on end?
Yeah, exactly. It's not like a new compound.
I think it's a lot of guesswork.
No, that's a good point. Because if you carbon date it, it literally, since it's a rock, it could have been there for much longer or even less.
What carbon are they going to find in a rock to date that's going to be decaying? And also, you know, they just assume that the rate of decay that carbon decays at is a constant that's remained constant the whole time. And, you know, there may have been different atmospheric conditions which changed the decay rate. So you just don't know. Well, much confusion is avoided if we distinguish between the origin of the Druids and the origin of Druidism. The official order seems most likely to have originated in Celtic Gaul. Whilst Druidism is pre-Celtic, it was adopted with little modification by the Celts migrating into the British Isles. Although Druids did not actually erect the stone circle, such as Stonehenge, it is acceptable to believe that they played an important part in the whole concept of Stonehenge. And I think I would agree with that. You know, maybe these stones could have been put up there and then the Druids used them, the same as the Christians used them as well, and used the holy wells and just Christianized them. But they're still in use today. I mean, there are still churches today that have got stone circles around them, and people put standing stones at the church because they're considered holy, or they were considered holy before Christianity took hold. there's links between them. And I think the same would have really happened with the Druids. And as these waves of what they call here Celts came into Britain, they brought new modifications to it, new ideas that came from the Near East. Because I do think it was like a central religion originally, about 5,000 years ago, maybe, right at the beginning. I think that would have been the belief that they had. And then it gradually evolved and became corrupted over time, I think.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the landmarks, I think I read somewhere a while back that there seems to be a correlation with the placement, and they happen to be placed on significant areas where there's magnetic crossovers and overlaps. So you have more of a kind of an energy charge or something. So there's something to do with the intersections of, the magnetic fields that cross over the Earth.
Telluric currents. They douse them. There's what they call them, like male and female lines. There's the Michael and the Mary line, and there's the Apollo and I think it might be Athena line. And you can douse them, and where they cross over is like a node point, and where they cross over is where the churches are put, or where the old megaliths are put. And that's where you can look in a line from when you get to one. You can look in a line and you'll see a whole line of holy sites going all the way up the country, and even going across Europe right the way to the Holy Land. There's a line, the St. Michael line, which goes right the way across from Skellig St. Michael, which is an island in Ireland. And then the line goes through St. Michael's Mount in Cornwall, and then it goes to Mont Saint-Michel in France, and it works its way right the way across through to the Holy Land, most of the sites are dedicated to St. Michael, which is why it's called the St. Michael line. So it can't be a coincidence. So yeah, they're put in places of energy. And also you always feel relaxed when you go to a stone circle, the same as when you go into a church. These places, they're usually put in places of great beauty, and it's just nice to be amongst the nature. And I guess we're cut off from that feeling nowadays by all the buzz of modernity, you know, all the engines going and all the electricity going and all the radio waves. So we probably don't feel, we're probably not as sensitive as the ancients were. They probably felt something in those places that we only get like a faint trace of today, I think.
Yeah, for sure. It's like we're disconnected from, you know, the stars in the sky.
Yeah,
with a lot of the light pollution. I mean, you know, when you go out into an open field where you're away from it, it's just kind of, you know, it just takes you outside of the world and kind of makes you feel somewhat insignificant, and it kind of puts things in perspective, doesn't it?
Well, and also bear in mind that a lot of these sites tie in with astrological things, astronomical things. They were like astronomical observatories. I was reading about the one in Callanish today, and the moon is right there on the horizon at Callanish because it's so far north. And one of the ancients was writing about this isle that the moon would visit once a year or whatever. And it was obviously talking about Callanish and the stone circle there. And when the sun comes up at the solstice and goes back down again, this guy, Alexander Thom, he worked out a lot of the astrological significance of these sites, and also that they all use the same unit of measurement. So they were obviously highly intelligent, and they had a hell of a lot of knowledge to know what was going on with the planets and the stars, and to be able to measure these things and get the proportions just right. Because I don't think they had rulers and measures like that. I think it was done with string and circles and a different way of doing geometry to the way that we do it today. But getting back to this, the origin of Druid, the word, is not known with certainty. One orthodox suggestion takes Uid as meaning knowing and Dru as a strengthening prefix, implying a very learned man, and that's from the Encyclopedia Britannica. Another suggestion is that the name Druid is derived from Druithin, meaning a servant of truth. So truth was central to the Druids, the truth against the world. In the year 1885, Professor Donald MacKinnon of Celtic Languages, Edinburgh University, offered the explanation that Druid is connected with and derived from the root that gives drus and dendron, as meaning oak and tree, respectively of the Greek. Drus as meaning wood in Sanskrit, tree in English, dwar as a grove, and drac an oak in Gaelic. Thus, in MacKinnon's opinion, the word druid is derived from the wood word for an oak, although he added that after the fall of druidism, there is no question that the word druid took on the meaning of a wise man. So there could be a link with oak there, and remember, there's a link with oak in the Old Testament, isn't there, of Abraham under the oak tree of Mamre, and also these groves that the druids used to use. Go on, do you want to say something?
I was just going to ask what the droves were. I don't know too much about them. The groves.
Groves. Well, neither do we. We just know that there were groves of apple trees or groves of a particular type of tree. In the Old Testament, it condemns some of them as having something to do with the fertility rites. But I don't think they were just necessarily just used for that, because we know that the Druids weren't idolaters. The thought is also expressed by E.O. Gordon in his works, Prehistoric London, which is a very good book. I do recommend that. The title Druid in Welsh, Derwyd or Derwyd, is said to be a compound of dar, superior, and gwyd, priest or inspector. The Irish der, a druid, is the absolver and remitter of sins. The same root is found in the Persian duri, a good and holy man, and in Arabic, dear, a wise man. So there are all these links there with these ancient languages, and it all means a similar thing. The Latin equivalent for druids is magi, and was used by early Irish and Welsh writers. The term magi may imply a kinship to the magi of the New Testament record, who saw his star in the east and came to worship the Christ child. So that may have been druids in the New Testament, the magi that came from Persia. So basically links here between the word for a holy man is similar throughout these different languages. It is acknowledged that most of our present day source material relating to the Druids is scanty and in the form of written documents, frequently in second hand quotations. Greek and Roman writers make occasional references to Druids in describing the Celts and their religion. The earliest reference appeared around the beginning of the 2nd century BC, then came the Irish folk stories and hero tales of the 4th and 5th centuries AD. The later Irish and Welsh triads provide a somewhat more revealing word picture of the Druids. And the BBC have tried to discredit the guy that had the biggest collection of these triads. And it was only them that tried to discredit him. And I think it was just because he drank some laudanum, which lots of people used to drink at the time. And they tried to say that the stuff that he had was fake, but the stuff that he had been referred to for hundreds of years before he was around. It was the same program that tried to rubbish the Colburn alphabet. It was like they did this attack job on Welsh history, basically. But these triads are the earliest records that we have of Britain, of the lore and all the rest of it. And E. Raymond Capp seems to think that they're genuine, and I trust his research. Julius Caesar wrote of the Druids, "They taught of the stars and their motions, the magnitude of the countries, the nature of things, and the power of God." Caesar further says of the Druids, "They hold aloof from war and do not pay war taxes. They are excused from military service and exempt from liabilities. Tempted by these, great many young men assemble of their own motion to receive their training." So it was a much sought after thing, basically, to be a druid. And they were highly knowledgeable and exempt from all liabilities. I mean, they must have been very, very good men to be given that exemption in law from all liabilities.
I wonder if they had to have certain criteria in order to become a druid, you know, similar to like the Levites of the Bible. They had to show their ancestry and kind of the lineage of being the ancestors of other kind of druids or Levites.
Yes, they did. They had to show it for 10 generations back, as we talked about before. We'll get into some descriptions of them and the differences between the three orders in a minute. Archaeology has shed considerable light on the Celtic culture, both in Europe and Britain, their building techniques, their weapons and tool types, their craftsmanship and burial modes. But material directly related to Druids is still lacking. As far as it is known, no authentic pre-Roman inscription referring to the word Druid has been found. In considering the archaeological evidence that may be related to the Druids, we find ourselves involved in assumptions and speculation. But we do know that the word was in use in Roman times. In describing the attire of the various Druidic orders, it must be pointed out that most of our information comes from the often highly imaginative and speculative writings and illustrations of 16th and 17th century writers. This was a period which began with a revival of interest in the Druids and culminated in the late Victorian period by presenting the Druids as the builders of Stonehenge. That's interesting because the earliest records of who built Stonehenge was claiming that Merlin flew over to Ireland and stole the stones from Ireland. And that's actually our earliest record. So they obviously looked at them and thought, well, how did these come to be? According to Celtic lore, Druidism was established under Hugadan the Mighty in three orders, Druids, Bards and Ovates. Each was delegated different duties. To be admitted to the order, a candidate was required to be of a good family and of high moral character. And again, we talked about that last week, about this high moral character. The lowest of the three divisions was the Ovate. They were believed to have dressed in green, an ancient emblem of innocence and youth, and under the supervision of a druid, studied the properties of nature and assisted in sacrificial ceremonies. The second division was that of the Bard. They were supposed to have dressed in brown and during religious ceremonies in a sky blue robe with a cowl. The colour blue, an emblem of the heavens and the sea, may have represented truth and harmony. The bards, whose function was to cultivate the art of music and poetry, as well as literature, are referred to by Strabo, the Greek geographer and historian, in 63 BC as hymn makers. They were responsible for the musical part of the worship services. And I'll just stop there because I've read that at these stone circles, they in Christian times, they had people that were just continually singing these hymns, which would have been like the chants that the monks do today. And that was supposedly a continuation of an earlier tradition, which would seem to tie in here with what Strabo was saying, that these bards were the hymn makers. They were continually right. singing.
I wonder our ancestors, Christian ancestors that used to do these chants, I think they tap into certain kind of frequencies that resonate with the body and almost put you in a trance-like state. So I just wonder if they would be the same. So I know other kind of chants from different kind of religions and that tend to utilize that resonance
frequency. Yeah, I would have thought so. Definitely, they would have sung to get themselves into a higher state. I would have thought. And there is a particular frequency. Someone was mentioning it the other day in the chat room, actually, about frequencies of music and what they can do. I mean, some music can make you feel really down, and other music can make you feel up, and it's all to do with the chord sequences, I guess, and the frequency that it's at. But these were also the words that they used were very important. These poets were held in high esteem by the Britons, for in their primeval civilization, musicians were like messengers from heaven, who spoke in a language that alone could banish anxiety and bring contentment to a troubled heart. The Druid bards survived the merging of Druidism into Christianity for centuries and enjoyed their ancient honours and privileges in many places down to the reign of Queen Elizabeth. And I guess that must have been Elizabeth I, because it doesn't say Elizabeth II here. The harp or lyre, usually pictured with the bard by Renaissance artists, is the primitive British or Irish harp. It was triangular in shape and strung with three strands of woven human hair. David may have played on just such a harp when he soothed the spirit of Saul the king and caused his wrath to depart. And remember, when we looked at the city of Ur that was in Mesopotamia, that was one of the things that was found in the great tomb there, was this really ornate harp. So they were playing these stringed instruments for thousands of years. And it's tied in with King David, obviously, and it's the symbol that the Irish still use, is the harp. And that was the main instruments that these bards would play. And it just makes to me, it seems so similar to today when we love our rock music and pop music, and they're playing electric guitars. That's basically the modern equivalent of the harp. So it hasn't changed, you know?
Yeah, just the sound, but generally stringed instruments have always been kind of within our culture.
Yeah.
And music.
Very important part of it. The third division, hang on. The third division of Druidism was that of Druid. These were the intellectual philosophers and physicians who directed the machinery of the state and the priesthood. No one could hold office who had not been educated by the Druids. On each seventh day, like the early Hebrew patriarchs, they preached to the people from small round eminences. Several of these eminences can still be seen in Britain. And I guess what they're talking about there is structures like Silbury Hill, which is a man-made mound. And when it talks in the Bible about Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, it obviously doesn't mean a mountain. I would have thought it was a mound, one of these mounds that the Druids used to preach on. That's what Jesus would have been preaching on, the Sermon on the Mount. So they're like a man-made hill, because obviously they didn't have electric amplification in those days, but you could stand up on the hill and everyone around you could hear what you were saying.
Ah, yeah, makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Is that what they was actually used for, a mount? Was a kind of deliberately built-up area that they would use to chant, speak from?
That's what we're told. I mean, we have these mounds there, and they're in central places. Like there's one in London, there's the White Mound, or the White Mount, it was called.
Mm.
And we're told that Jesus was on this mount, and we have the tales that have come down to us that's what they were used for, climbing up on top of and speaking. English literary sources give us six successive degrees of the Druidic order. Each degree was differentiated by the colour of their sashes. They were always dressed in long robes, which descended to the feet, while the robes of the lower orders wore only knee length. The Druidic robe was white to symbolise purity, a colour they also used to symbolise the sun. Instead of sandals, they wore wooden shoes of a pentagonal shape. Around their necks, they wore golden torques or neck pieces. And again, I'll just stop there, because the Welsh were wearing clogs right up until about 50 years ago. Wooden shoes. And that's what clogs. The British used to wear. And they were doing it right up till the modern day. Just like the Dutch, they used to wear clogs as well. And most descriptions indicate their hair was worn short and their beards long, whereas the lesser orders were clean-shaven. The Britons in general wore moustaches on their upper lips and their hair long. Again, that's interesting, with the shaved head and the beard, rather monk-like. And that's almost like Muslim-like today, isn't it? The long beard and short hair.
Yeah. Did they shave the tash?
We were saying that the Britons in general wore moustaches on their upper lips, whereas the Druids were clean-shaven. Well, the young Druids were clean-shaven, and the older Druids had long beards. So I guess the length of your beard must have, or what type of facial hair you had, must have signified where you were in society, what position you were in.
I was just going to say the Muslims tend to have like a long beard on the chin, but then they have a sort of a very short moustache. They trim that bit, and it's quite distinct, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's also interesting. I mean, black people don't grow beards. That was noted upon in the past as well. And Oriental people have difficulty growing beards as well. And yet when we look at these ancient statues and things from Assyria, they've got really lush beards, haven't they? really thick beards. They're definitely white people to have beards like that. The highest degree and spiritual head of the organisation was the Archdruid. It is believed there were usually two Archdruids in Britain, one residing on the Isle of Anglesey and the other on the Isle of Man. The Gildas manuscript from the Cottonian Library lists three Archdruids in Britain, and there may have been other Archdruids in Gaul. This is obviously where we get the term Archbishop from, is from Archdruid. The robe of the Archdruid is described as extremely ornate and embellished with gold, having a cumric or tau cross wrought in gold down the length of the back. They also wore a tiara or crown of gold, embossed with a number of points to represent the sun's rays, and a breastplate of the same metal. And that's similar to the Levites. The head priest used to have a breastplate with gems in the breastplate. Traditional Irish lore says that the Archdruid generally carried a golden scepter, and on special occasions his head was surmounted by a garland of oak leaves. The Archdruid also had other symbolical implements, such as a peculiarly shaped golden sickle with which he cut the mistletoe from the oak. The Druids are said to have founded 40 universities, having at one time an enrollment of over 60,000 students. The Druids and Bards received up to 20 years of training in the tenets and moral teachings of their orders. Three severe examinations, held in three consecutive years, had to be successfully completed before the candidate received full initiation into the highest grades. And we know that from Caesar, about the number of universities. Every king had his Druid and Bard attached to his court. The Druidic priest or teacher of wisdom not only directed the education of the youthful members of the court, but was allowed to instruct other pupils. He travelled through the realm, often accompanied by his students. The chief bard seems to have had a number of assistants of various degrees who had not yet arrived at the highest achievement of their profession. So they seem to be sort of like doctors, scientists, teachers, just generally all-round intelligent people that have been educated to the highest standards that there were. While no literary documents exist to prove the date of the establishment of Druidism in Britain, the educational system adopted by the Druids is traced to about 1800 BC, when Hugadan Hiscion, or Hugh the Mighty, led a party of settlers from Asia Minor to Britain. A descendant of Abraham, Hugh the Mighty's coming to Britain provides one of the first recorded instances of the fulfilment of the prophecy found in Genesis 28:14, that the seed of Abraham would spread abroad to the four points of the compass. And E. Raymond Capp there, he says Hugadan Hiscion, and he thinks that that Hiscion might well be derived from Isaac's son. And obviously, I mean, we've talked before about the migrations that that came into Britain. So I'm not sure which one that would have been. But when everybody spread out after Noah, you get down to Abraham and then his descendants. I think what he's referring to here is that it would have been Israelite descendants.
Yeah.
Well, the Welsh triads or traditional chronicles give evidence of Hugh the Mighty coming from Asia Minor. In the Welsh triad number 4, we read that the first of the three chieftains who established the colony was Hugh the Mighty, who came with the original settlers. They came over the hazy sea from the summer country, which is called Defrabani, which is where Constantinopolis now stands. So that's talking about Constantinople. So it's saying that it came over from Asia Minor, or what is now Turkey. Through his investigations made over 200 years ago, the English antiquarian William Stukeley asserts that true Druidism was introduced into Britain from Bible lands about the period of Abraham. He further states it was undoubtedly derived from the original, undefiled religion of the patriarchs. Many other authorities have noted the resemblance between the Druidic religion and that of the Old Testament. To quote Charles Hulbert, a noted British scholar, "So near is the resemblance between the Druidic religion of Britain and the patriarchal religion of the Hebrews that we hesitate not to pronounce their origin the same." The patriarchal religion to which Hulbert refers consisted of family-centered worship, with the head of the family acting in the capacity of priest while doing the service of sacrifice. And that goes right back to the times of Cain and Abel, and Abel sacrificing and Cain killing him, and then it was the firstborn son of the family that would do the sacrificing. Going back to the time of Melchizedek as well. So this was like a religion that preceded Abraham's one, basically. Apparently, most present-day scholars consider such conclusions absurd and imaginary. One modern writer refers to a time when the biblical pedigree of the ancient European barbarians was being explored and invented. Yet in the same works, he discusses curious links with Central Asia, an area that was occupied for a time during the westward movements of the Hebrew Phoenicians after the flood. So they'll rubbish this, but then they'll find evidence that says, oh, we came from Asia Minor in the exact area that it tells you, you know, Padan Aram, the exact area that Abraham and his descendants were in. While there is admittedly little direct evidence of the biblical origin of Druidism, the many parallelisms and similarities cannot be dismissed with sarcasm and contempt. Rather, they would indicate a need for more research and study. It is true that Stukeley and other writers of his time did err in advocating the Druids of the Celtic period as being the builders of Stonehenge, but this in itself is not justifiable grounds to discredit all his works. I mean, that was just one theory that he had. English literature is full of references to the pagan religious customs of the Druids. The early writers described the Druids as soothsayers, performing religious rites and practices in which the planets, trees, and stones were given divine honours. However, this is only describing the idolatrous worship of the Celtic Druids. As they migrated through Europe into the British Isles, they brought with them that which is today erroneously described as Druidism. So he's saying that they had corruptions that they brought with them, which are the same corruptions as to why they were, why the Israelites were removed from Israel and Judah in the first place. And it talks about it in Jeremiah, about how they used to cut down a tree and decorate it. It sounds very much like a Christmas tree. And these other practices. Well, yeah.
That's exactly what we do, isn't it?
We still do today, yeah. Although the Druids performed idolatrous ceremonies to the stars, to the elements, to hills, and to the trees, they never thoroughly forsook the worship of the supreme God of all nature. In fact, it is quite possible that the Druids paid honours rather than adoration to their many deities. We also now know that some practices of occult and magic arts ascribed to the Druids consisted for the most part of no more than a thorough knowledge of nature and some of the sciences, including astronomy. However, over the centuries there has developed a literary record of an entire system of Druid practices now so entwined with Celtic occult belief and folklore that it has all but obliterated the original philosophy of Druidism. And I guess New Age ideas have also corrupted it. Lots of New Age ideas, lots of New Age anti-Christian ideas from people that don't realise that Druidism evolved into Christianity. We have a great amount of comparative evidence showing the close relationship between Druidism and the faith of the Old Testament, which gives validity to the story of Hugh Gadarn introducing the patriarchal faith to Britain. Centuries later, this pure theology was merged into the religion of the Celts, traces of which can still be recognised. One outstanding comparison is the altars of the Celtic Druids, which were constructed of unhewn stones. For by Druidic law, it was ordained that no axe should touch the sacred stones. This precept, which gave rise to the sacred stone worship of the Druids, actually coincides with the Mosaic law. If thou wilt make me an altar of stone, thou shalt not build it of hewn stone. That's Exodus 20:25. Sometimes the stones were anointed with rose oil, as Jacob anointed the first stone monument on record, that which he raised as a memorial at Bethel. So the first stone monument on record, that's on a written record, is in the Bible. And yet people think, you know, that these stones which we have are all pagan and, you know, are something to do with anti-Christian stuff. And yet the first record there is of actually putting up one of these stones is there in the Bible. While officiating at the altar, the priest would lay his hand on the animal to be sacrificed, making a confession of sin. Then the animal was slain and offered as a burnt sacrifice. These ancient Druids believed expiation followed this sacrificial act, a belief which was an exact parallel to the Hebrew doctrine of blood atonement. And that, I mean, wow. That's recorded by Caesar that they were doing that, and that's why they did it.
I mean, that's pretty much spot on, isn't it? There's so many consistencies that it's hard to, you know, to tell them apart in many ways.
It is. The Druids also held the doctrine of the immortality of the soul. Caesar, in his commentaries, wrote, "The Druids make the immortality of the soul the basis of all their teaching, holding it to be the principal incentive for a virtuous life." Pomponius Mela, writing about AD 41, affirms, "The bravery of the Britons is due to their doctrine of the immortality of the soul." Undoubtedly, Druidism was the strength of the British resistance to the Romans, who failed in their attempts to completely destroy it. So they knew about the immortality of the soul. They didn't think that they were just, you know, going down into the ground and wouldn't be coming back or could do whatever they wanted in this life. They knew they had to lead a virtuous life, and they were, you know, making these offerings for sin as well, these sacrifices.
Yeah. I mean, we spoke the other week that Rome tried to destroy Druidism, but the fact that it pretty much dissolved within Britain and around Europe, dissolved into Christianity, goes to show that, you know, they were pretty much one in the same, because if they were strong enough to withstand sort of pagan, you know, idolatry from Rome, but readily embraced Christianity, it kind of goes to show that there's they're akin in their mindset.
Yeah, the Romans couldn't destroy it. I mean, they banned it, and they were frightened of it because it gave the Britons their strength to fight back. You know, they were fearless and wanted to lay down their lives for their country. I mean, again, it's a Christian thing, isn't it? You know, no greater love does a man have than he lays down his life for his brother or for his friend, which means lay down your life for your nation. While apparently accepting sun worship and other pagan practices, the Druids worshipped the one true God, who was triune in nature, who portrayed the triple aspect of the past, the present, and the future. He was the creator of the past, the savior of the present, and the renovator of the future. They believed his real name to be an indescribable mystery, as was his nature. They reasoned that God cannot be matter. What is not matter must be God. And we spoke about the name that they had for God, which was Yisu, last week. The Druids revered the oak tree as a symbol of Almighty God, as did the Hebrew patriarchs. It was underneath the oaks of Mamre that Abraham dwelt a long time, where he erected an altar to God, and where he received the three angels. It was underneath an oak that Jacob hid the idols of his children in Genesis 35:4, because oaks were held to be sacred and inviolate. I think this is happening in the Holy Land. The oak trees there were held to be sacred, exactly the same as the Druids held the oaks to be sacred. So again, there's a link there. And I mean, you don't often think of oak trees growing over there, do you? People think, oh, it's desert.
Well, yeah, the climate's changed. And,
yeah, I mean, probably it's pretty similar to how Britain looks, is how it looked back then.
Yeah.
And trees.
If you think about it as well, if you're a people of agriculture, you would follow the land, with the fertile land, wouldn't you? You'd follow it, and, you know, because that's how you've learned to sustain yourself. So you would naturally kind of gravitate or migrate towards land which enables you to be kind of fruitful in the way that you've known.
Well, the Israelites were farmers. They were great farmers and agrarians and shepherds. And the festivals that they had were all based upon times of year when the harvesting needed to be done, when the planting needed to be done, and there were festivals of offering up the first fruits, and they had laws about how they weren't allowed to touch a plant until it was something like 3 years old. They were just to allow the fruit to drop. They were told that if they didn't do that, then they would suffer for it. And you can imagine that when they did that, they had great big fruits and enough to go around. And then you look at today, and you used to have to eat one apple a day, and then it was 3 pieces of fruit a day, then it was 5 pieces of fruit a day, and now it's 8 pieces of fruit a day you're supposed to eat. You can imagine back then, you just needed one piece of fruit, because the land wasn't being overused it was being underused in effect. So there was more nutrients to go around and the food would have been so much healthier. You know, we overuse everything today. Because mistletoe grew upon the oak, it became sacred to the Druids and was held symbolic of the coming deliverer or the branch. Mistletoe was known as the All Heal, a title which bears a strange resemblance to the words of Malachi's prophecy concerning the sun who should rise with healing in his wings. This branch was not only foretold by the prophets of ancient Israel, but was sung also by the poets of classic antiquity. Virgil mentions the golden branch, and Homer speaks of the golden rod or branch. A parallel can be seen in the writings of three of the Old Testament prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Zechariah, all referring to the coming Messiah as the branch. So the Druids also used to refer to this coming deliverer as the branch. It is of interest to note that the Druids revered a form of the cross. It was their custom to search diligently for a large, handsome oak tree having two large, arm-like branches. When viewed in conjunction with the trunk of the tree, they formed a cross. This cross was then consecrated by cutting characters for the word Jesus, spelled Yesu, upon the right branch. Upon the middle trunk, they cut the word Tyrannus, upon the left branch, Balenus, and over them all, the word Than, meaning God. So that, I mean, that's like a runic symbol as well, isn't it, with the three there. And I've always thought that that symbol for life is the same as Christ on the cross. It's the same symbol. The runic symbol for life is the same symbol as Christ on the cross is for eternal life.
Yeah.
And I think that ties in with this. Jesus, or Yesu, was the supreme God whom they worshipped as the great all-heal, and they believed in him as the saviour of the world. In both the Druidic religion and the Hebrew religion of patriarchal times, we can see a parallel preparation for the coming of Christ. The Old Testament prophets proclaimed that the promised Messiah would come as a babe, grow to be a great teacher, and finally be revealed as the Redeemer. Through the ministry of the Druids, the same doctrines were believed, with the expectation of the same saviour, Jesus, or Jesus. In the ancient British tongue, Jesus had never assumed its Greek, Latin, or Hebrew form, but remained the pure Druidic Jesus, or Yesu. Taliesin, the Welsh bard of the 6th century, wrote, "Christ, the Word from the beginning, was in the beginning our teacher, and we never lost his teachings. Christianity was a new thing in Asia, but there never was a time when the Druids of Britain held not its doctrines." And again, we pointed that out the other week, and the fact that he's referring to the Word, which is what Christ is referred to in the Gospel of John, the Logos. So it's saying Christ, the Logos, was there from the beginning as our teacher. And that's showing you that that you know, Logos, the study of things, education, all of it was based on religion, and it all tied in with Christianity. So it sort of confirms what Dr. E. Michael Jones talks about, you know, about the Logos being that important. And it sort of confirms that Taliesin in the 6th century is writing about how important that was. And he refers to Christ as the Word from the beginning.
Yeah.
Other clues showing close relationship between Druidism and the patriarchal religion are seen in that each had a high priest with a breastplate of a similar description. Both had a priesthood exempt from taxation and military service. Both religions taught the Mosaic account of the creation. And we talked about that in the first episode of this. Despite its practice of pagan rites in high places and sacred groves, it was the Druidic faith rooted in Druidism that nurtured the essential divine truths and prepared Britain for the gospel of Jesus Christ. When Christianity reached Britain, Druidism merged with it. Many of the Druidic priesthood became ministers in the early Christian church, and they went on to carry the message of Christianity to the far nations of the world. This is not to imply that every individual Druid and bard accepted Christianity on its first promulgation in Britain. Even after Christianity became the national religion of Britain, Druidism did not entirely cease until several centuries after Christ. And we will eventually get to Britain becoming Christian. But we've got this other section that I want to get into now, which is about the continuation of Druidry. But have you got any comments there, Patriarch, you want to make on that and the connections between Druidry and the patriarchal religion before I move into the next section?
Not that I've already mentioned, to be honest. There's some similarities between sacrifices and just general doctrines and understanding of the, you know, monotheistic central creator.
Yeah, and the creation as well. Their creation story is the same, pretty similar. Anyway, the pronunciation in the Mosaic account is "Let there be light," and in the Druidic account, God pronounces something, pronounces His own name, and light appears, and everything then comes from light. Well, this next selection of quotes comes from the Trojan War of 650 BC by Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett. So finally, we arrive at the major issue which has bedeviled everything from AD 597 onwards, the vexed question of British Druidism. Contrary to anxious Christian hopes and assertions, British Druidism never really died out, and it was never lost, nor was it forgotten. It was, in fact, comprehensively recorded and re-recorded down the centuries, and we still have it today. As a religious philosophy and a way of life, it transcends the harsher and more primitive Christian religion. And of course, they're not Christian, but all their research points to the truth of Christian identity, basically. It is a far more profound and developed system of thought and philosophy, and some researchers believe it a more suitable way of life and religion for the British mind. The preservation of Druidic thought and practice allows for a comparison to be made between this highly advanced British culture and the cultures of the people of the ancient Logrian and Cymric homelands. And Logria was England and Cymric was Wales. Many hundreds of ancient village and local customs and festivals can be traced back to Druidic survivals. Historical evidence for its survival is extraordinary in its amount, and the commencement of publishing the ancient Cymric Welsh records in AD 1800 undoubtedly contributed to the alarm amongst Edwin Guest and Bishop Stubbs and their adherents, and that's the people that have tried to discredit the Welsh histories. Various facts amongst a huge number are the records of the initiation of a major Welsh prince into the Druidic rites in AD 1156, the Scottish Church Commissioners forcing the ploughing of previously never tilled sacred Druidic land as late as 1678, and the seizure of the image of Darfel Gadarn from the Diocese of St. Asaph in Wales in 1538, where over 600 offerings, including cattle, had been made. And I wonder if that Darfel Gadarn, if he was something to do with Hugh Gadarn. It shows you that, you know, the truth of these legends, because there were 500 years ago, there were still people making offerings to the originator of Druidism. The image and the friar, it says here, were taken to Smithfield in London and burned. An annual sacrifice of a lame calf was made at St. Beno's until these times. This, of course, to say nothing of the Druids of Pontypridd, reformed and practicing in the early 20th century. Bulls were sacrificed in the parish of Gairloch in Rossshire as late as 1649, according to the records of the Presbytery of Dingwall. In Cornwall, there are still annual horse ceremonies, as at Padstow, with the death of the old horse on the eve and the rebirth of the new on May Day. And certainly in Mastegg in Glamorgan, a group was still parading the Marie Hluid decorated horse skull in the late 1980s. There are many hundreds of these survivals, including the well-known Ride of the Lady Godiva in Coventry, which is a thinly disguised Ishtar ceremony. Best known of all is the Winterfire ceremony, celebrated by all the British for 3,600 years. It was held on the 1st of November, but after the failure of Guy Fawkes to blow up the King, the Lords and Parliament in 1604, the cunning politicians seized the chance to legitimise the rites, which they could not eliminate, and proclaimed that the fires were lit to celebrate the survival of the professional politicians on the 5th of November. A likely story. In North Wales, young men leapt through the winter bonfire flames to escape the black short-tailed sow. In Cornwall, the midsummer bonfires were lit on June the 23rd, starting from Carn Brae, and the young people leapt across the embers to drive off evil and bring good luck. This was disguised by simply transforming it into a pretend celebration of the Eve of St. John. Something more on this can be said later, but suffice it to say that most people only know what the enemies of Druidism have said about it. Druidism, in fact, bears no resemblance whatsoever to the popular notions of meaningless annual sun worship at Stonehenge, as well-intended as this may be. The early Welsh priesthood were then simply a continuation of the Druids. The three levels of Druids were basically first the Druith, the governor or reader, the elder experienced priest, second the bard, the recorder of the philosophy, the history, the religious rites, the births, deaths and marriages, and the singer and propagator of all these things, and third the ovate, the novices and disciples of the bards. So whilst the higher order became increasingly the specialised priesthood, the bards continued their function of recording and propagating and training the ovates, who would be the next generation of bards. In the days of book writing, each bard wrote his book, and in turn his ovate, when he became a bard, wrote his own book, which mainly was a reiteration of his master's book with his own continuations. This process of reproduction rolled on and on down the centuries, and so today we have the copies of copies of copies, many quite old, which preserve for us our own British ancestral philosophy and religion. This had begun to be published piecemeal in 1784, and perhaps earlier, and a comprehensive volume, Bardas, was published in 1858, containing the collected works of a number of notable bards. As these ancient sages knew that life began in the oceans in the most primitive forms, and gradually developed in ascending fashion down the millennia before evolving into advanced mammals, and finally man, in this they anticipated Darwin by several millennia. They held that neither time nor space were absolutes, and this thinking that parallels the theory of relativity has been remarked upon by other interested researchers. Abaris, who first taught the Greeks, was a Druidic instructor. That this advanced, complex, and indeed modern religion would have alarmed Christian fundamentalists in all eras is unquestionable. Druidism also supported and encouraged the advancement of knowledge and science, which they believed would enhance the development of the soul. An immediate comparison made by Baron Blackett and Alan Wilson was that between the Epic of Gilgamesh, the King of Uruk, which survives in five epic poems from ancient Sumerian literature. Two poems, Gilgamesh and the Land of the Living, and the Death of Gilgamesh, have been noted to use language much like a lament for Ur-Nammu, the father of Dungi or Diocletian of Ur, who is of great interest. Versions of these poetic epics were found written on clay tablets in the library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh, and these match elementary themes in the medieval Arthurian romance tales. These themes in these ancient tablets appear to be those of the Sangreal. Next there are the Seven Tablets of Creation, thought to be of Babylon and found in the library of Ashurbanipal of Assyria at Nineveh, now Konunik. These stories again have distinct parallel themes with the British creation stories as preserved in the four branches of the Mabinogi. Mabinogi means origins or genesis, whereas the incorrect Mabinogion means children's tales, and Mabinogion is a famous collection of Welsh legends. By labelling the Mabinogi tales as Mabinogion, or four children's tales, the stories could be protected from the destructive paranoia of later Christians. The Seven Tablets of Creation, recording the Babylonian creation epic, are now safe in the British Museum, and they are published. Several other Mabinogi tales, which are obviously solar stories, also appear to mirror the themes of the Seven Tablets of Creation and other recovered Sumerian epics. Anyone who has read the Sangreal of AD 1106 will recall that after every two or three pages, the narrative is interrupted and a sententious paragraph is inserted that incongruously attempts to explain the text into Christian dogma. This would be to avoid inevitable destruction by the servants of Rome. In the same way, much of the mystical ancient poetry of Britain forms a record of initiation ceremonies into the ancient sacred secrets of the Druids, as has been detailed by several researchers and authors. At the end of the day, we still have the ancient lore and the perceived lore of our ancestors. It perhaps needs to again be made clear that if the same levels of hostile criticism were made against them, then it would be necessary to throw out and reject the Rig Veda, the Popolva, the Avestia, the Kabbalah, all Greek and Roman records, all the Hebrew records and Holy Scriptures, and much more. The philosophical triads, the moral triads, the religious triads, and the historical triads are all available to us to draw ancient parallels. The laws of the King Donald Malmud, Donald the Bold, of around 420 BC are available, as are the laws of circa AD 920, compiled by the Prince Blegwyrid to compare jurisprudence. Reliable accounts of bardic philosophy and lore are available in plenty. The most important of many discoveries in Britain was the finding of three ancient ships in the mud of the River Humber in 1937. These were instantly labelled as Viking ships and placed in a museum. Over 50 years passed, and finally, someone had the idea to radiocarbon 14 test these ships' timbers. The result was a date of around 1600 BC, with a plus or minus possibility of a few centuries either way. This unmistakably places these vessels into the era of the Albion invasion from ancient Chaldean Syria. This posed no problems for the academics, and a young lady wrote a book in which she somewhat absurdly claimed that the ships were of Egyptian provenance. Nothing changes, and they wrote about that in one of their other books called The Discovery of the Ark of the Covenant in 2007. They do have some wacky, wild and wacky ideas, but at the same time, they pull up a lot of information that you're not going to find anywhere else. Like this ship, you know, that says 1600 BC, and yet they thought it was a Viking ship because it showed a level of technology that they didn't think that the Britons had. And then when they discovered that, they then said, oh, well, it must be Egyptian. But we have this legend that we came from Syria at that time.
Yeah, I mean, that is pretty interesting. Who was the one you was reading earlier that pretty much came up with some hypotheses which predated Darwin?
The Druids.
The
Druids did, yeah.
So they kind of perceived that there was a connection or origins to sea life.
Yeah, I think they saw that life gradually got more and more complex as it was created. They had like the creation from light, and then everything went in degrees of complexity. We were hearing about that in the last episode, I think, or the one before that, about how things started off with simple organisms, and the simple organisms got more complex, and there were different orders of these organisms. And the value of them is based on, you know, how friendly they are to man or how useful they are to man. And then eventually you actually get to man. And I'm not sure that they were saying that, you know, the theory of evolution, but they were basically saying there are different orders throughout the world of creation, basically different orders of creatures. And they get more and more complex as you work your way up. I'm not sure they said that they evolved, but what the Druids were saying is that they were created in that order. Creation, as creation picked up steam, more and more complex life forms appeared. That sort of thing, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense. It reminds me of I used to listen to a lot of Alan Watts back in the day. If you ever heard of him, he's kind of like a philosopher. And he talks about how, you know, when you flick paint or something, you know, you have the larger splats kind of on the inner circle, and then towards the edges you get the more fine details, and in it's a similar concept in that way, and the same with kind of the solar system. As it stretches out, you get more and more kind of, you know, intricate and numerous amounts of stars.
The more you measure it, the more there appears to be of it. You know, the better you get at measuring, the more there is of something. The better you get with a magnifying glass or a telescope, the further you can see, the more there is there. I mean, originally you just think, well, there's just what we can see, and then you get a lens and you can see that there's much more, and then time comes into it, and you realise that it just goes back, and it just sort of continues. That makes me think, you know, creation happened in an instant or whatever, and everything looks as if it's always been here, the same as it would in a dream. And if you tried to measure the coast of Britain, and you went into every, you know, around every little rock and pebble, I mean, it would be endless, wouldn't it, with measuring? And the more we get in there with a microscope, the more we look at, the better we get at looking, the more there is there, and we end up with atoms and spaces between them, and then we end up with the crazy ideas that physics have, that, you know, 99% of everything isn't here, and we have to invent dark matter to keep it all together. You know, there's no evidence for it. Now they're saying, oh, they've discovered a black hole. Well, a black hole apparently sucks in all the light and everything, and you can't see it. And yet somehow they've managed to say, well, we've detected a black hole. Only it doesn't quite fit Einstein's description of what one was, but they're still going to call it a black hole anyway, because otherwise Einstein would be proved wrong. It's a crazy system that we have. I think they're probably more accurate back then. But I think, I think we'll leave that here for today then, and then finally get into the Romans in the next episode, I think, unless you've got any final thoughts on summing up on the Druids or any of the subjects we covered in the last three episodes, Patriarch.
I know. I mean, it's all very interesting. I really didn't have any knowledge of the Druids, to be honest, other than the stereotypical things you see and watch on TV. So it was really insightful, as and they clearly were a crucial part of our history.
Well, that's why I want to do this series, because so much of our history people just don't know, they're not aware of, or they have, false ideas of it. I mean, people think of Druids today and they think of New Age witches and pagans, or they think of Freemasons, or they think of people dancing around at Stonehenge, getting out of their tree. And they don't realise the origins of it and how it was such a strong religion. It enabled us to defeat Rome, which we'll hear more about. And also that they were looked up to very much so by the Greek philosophers and the Roman ones. And their knowledge of the stars and navigation and astronomy was just incredible, just impossible without divine revelation, I would suggest. Some of the way that some of these stone circles are aligned. So yeah, it is interesting stuff. And I've put the books that we've used as references in the notes so people can check them out, and we'll get back into R.W. Morgan's work in the next episode. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, as always.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next time with a new episode of Patriotic History. And until then, of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.